Welcome, travelers. I'm Josh.
And I'm Lee Wanika, and this is Tabletop Journeys, where we will be your not-so-humble guides on the quest for RPG adventures.
Now, here's a message from friends of the show.
My name is Nick Perrin, and I'm an actor, writer, and game master. And on Tabletopped, I talk with an expert game master every week to find out the best ways to run amazing games and tell epic stories. Looking to start DMing? Or maybe you've been a game master for a long time and want to spice up your table? Then this podcast is for you. Tabletopped is released on Mondays wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everybody, to tonight's episode. Excited to be cracking into yet another new gaming book, which has come out literally within the last week before we sat here down here to go ahead and talk. But from across the microphone, across the great state of Massachusetts, on the other side of New England, Mr. Lee Winnie Camiller staring me in the face. How are you doing today, sir? What's up with you? How are you doing?
I am doing very well, very well. I've been looking forward to this for quite some time. Just love what we're getting ready to do. But lately, it's been a lot of prep work. It's been a lot of work on writing. It's been a lot of work getting our episodes ready for the podcast. Had a great time Sunday night on the live stream I'm a player in. The chapter rolled back to my character on Streams of Sphero, specifically the War of the Lich King. So we had our first episode of that chapter Sunday night, and that was a lot of fun. Did some really cool things in that game. The second time in the history of Ben being my DM, we have done a crossover with home games that I've run that were not initially part of Alanis. That was very cool, and a character from one of my recent homebrew campaigns has crossed over to Sphero in this case. So nice. It's going to be pretty interesting.
We are in the height of toddlerhood, so my attention has been drawn a million different directions from the cutest little tornado in a teapot you have ever run across. But man alive, I had forgotten the pace that toddlers run, man. It is like, I am surprised that there's not like a toddler Olympics, because they'd be breaking world records all over the place, running marathons and everything like that. Man, it's the bestest time, but whew. I was very excited earlier today to go ahead and sit down and finally record another chapter of Dr. Homebrew. That was a lot of fun talking about the next chapter in Keys from the Golden Vault, having a lot of fun with those, talking about the really interesting Snurf Nevlin, Eberron inspired Dark Underdark themed mission called Talkworks Clockworks. So a lot of fun to go ahead and talk about. It's this really interesting mix between lighthearted, goofy characters, right, in this really like dark, gritty, mechanized. It's really weird. I'm dying to know who wrote these missions, because when I read the one before this, Prisoner 13, I was like, oh man, this has got Sadie Lowry written all over it. From the very beginning, I was like, yeah, this has got to be Sadie Lowry. And I'm dying to know who wrote this one, because this is an interesting mission with some very interesting pieces. That video will be coming out in a couple of days. By the point that you're listening to this episode, the video will already be out. So yeah, I'd like to go ahead and get your thoughts on that.
The one thing I did not mention that I also was considering and looking into over the weekend, when I was taking a break from reading up on the topic we're talking about tonight, I was continuing our prep work for our upcoming show on Quest for the Infinite Staircase. Spoiler alert for an episode we have not yet recorded. I am loving what I'm reading. And to the point where I am trying to figure out when I'm going to be running either a campaign or a major portion of a campaign. It's just really, really good. I like the mission. I like the adventures they selected for it. Some of them are favorites of mine from way back that I played when they first came out, and they were brand new and in shiny plastic. There's a couple that I had not actually played that I was aware of, but I had not actually played. And man, they're so good. It's not even just the quality of the of each adventure, but it's the way they tie them together that's so good. We'll get into that when we talk about it.
Yep. All right. So tonight we're going to be talking about another brand new gaming book that isn't out from Wizards of the Coast and Dungeons and Dragons. We are going to be cracking into the release that caught some of us by surprise about when it was going to. We knew that it was coming. We did not know the precise day that it was going to drop. But the PDF version of the Star Trek Adventures, second edition of the core rulebook, has dropped. And all of us in our little Star Trek adventure world, boy, we have been tearing through this thing. It is, if you are not in the Star Trek Adventures communities, first of all, you're missing out. Second of all, it is like a hive of bald-faced hornets that has just been hit with a baseball bat. Like, there's activity, they are flying around, there are questions coming left and right. I can only imagine what Jim Johnson and Al Spader and Mike Dismuke's inbox is like right now. It's got to be just a bazillion things, because we have found a bunch of things that are just really, really interesting and really, really neat. And it's certainly going to be impacting, obviously our cast show, Star Trek Preservations. There are going to be implications on that. I think that at this point, Luanika and I are still of the mind, and this may have shifted a little bit, but we're still of the mind at this point that we don't totally know how it's going to impact the show in terms of, like, when are we going to shift to second edition, but we will be shifting to second edition. If not, I mean, at this point, we've already recorded 7 episodes of this year, so there's only 3 episodes left to go, so I don't know if we'll do it in the in-between season break, like in November and December, and convert characters, or maybe try to do some short treks to go ahead and move the characters from one to the other in the meantime, but we will be moving to second edition. The question is a matter of when at this point, and for some of the reasons that we're talking about tonight, about how we want to go ahead and get some of these mechanics under our hands. That's where I think we left the discussion, Luminika. Does that jive with where you think we left the discussion?
I think so, but as I've been reading the actual rule book, some of my opinions may be changing on that. So we might just have this discussion live for everybody to hear. So for starters, I will say that when the core rulebook, the PDF dropped, that dropped last week at the point of time we're recording. That was just for those who pre-ordered with Modiphius. So if you pre-ordered the physical book, you got the PDF starting last Wednesday. I believe that would have been the 24th. And anybody who has pre-ordered the physical book since then pretty much gets that PDF immediately. Yep. Also, if you pre-ordered the GM toolkit, which came out slightly afterwards, you would get that as well. So having pre-ordered both, I have both, which is pretty exciting. I think my plan is to use the On the Right Path blog to dive deeper into the GM toolkit. We'll have that on our YouTube channel, and we'll get into some of the coolness that's there. That way we can keep this strictly about the core rules. As far as what we're likely to do, we largely started some of the character shifts where possible when the Quick Start Guide came out a few months ago. We had already instituted pastimes, so all the players had the ability to select pastimes and shift a focus and basically select a new focus to replace a pastime if they had a pastime as a focus to begin with. So that had already been done. That particular rule was already done. And we had already shifted for the characters whose species was in the Quick Start Guide. We had already shifted the species trait from the second edition rules as well. So that created a new talent for some, but there was, I think there's somebody who didn't have the ability to do that yet. I think everybody in this cast had the ability.
I think it was an Expeditions character.
It's Expeditions who have some keys that they didn't have access to until last week. Make sure it runs smoothly to make sure we're up to speed on how all the rules work so we know what we're doing. Likely, it'll be running it with Expeditions next month, and then we'll make a final determination of will we fully convert, will we start doing all the things. Because honestly, one of the most complicated pieces, we figured out a way to get it down so we can do that fairly smoothly. So changing that on the show before we need to might be a little weird. We're going to run it a few times, get good at it. I've got some events coming up where I'm going to be playtesting and running players with the new rules that I'll be doing 100% second edition. So once we get a few more things under our belts, then we'll be able to jump in and make that switch. So whether it's episode 8 or 9, probably my guess is 9 before we're fully converted, but it might even be 10 before we're fully converted also.
Yeah, I think that in terms of some of the rules changes that they've made, it's nice that the rules changes that they've made have been with an eye to streamline complicated mechanics, right? When we first started talking about Star Trek Adventures, about a year ago now, give or take, probably more than that, actually, and we started talking about the core rule book, that was very much one of the things we talked about. It was like, oh boy, there's a lot in this, and a lot of it is really complicated. And so it's nice that they have gone to fix some of the complication without losing the sauce of the rule, which is very, very nice. The thing that I would say about that in terms of like our recording of preservations is that a lot of the slipstreaming that they've done in the rules to go ahead and help streamline some of the things are things that we were doing anyway, right? When we start talking about extended challenges, when we talk about challenge dice, even on some level, there's going to be some things that we, in the course of trying to make the story move quickly and smoothly, hand-waved a little bit under first edition, which are now codified in second edition. Yep. And that's good. That's a good thing, because I think that experienced storytellers found that there was a lot of bulk that was unnecessary and got in the way of the narrative, because extended challenges in particular, right? Like, that was one of those things that not a lot of people did because they really dragged things down. When we had an entire episode that was really just one drawn-out extended challenge, Joe Harney, who plays Captain Tobor, even pointed it out in our cast chat, like, hey, friends, let's not forget what we just did here. We just made an episode that was nothing but an extended challenge sound good and sound fun and sound engaging. It's nice that some of the things that we did to go ahead and help spice them up a little bit are now at least in the rules to help other storytellers do the same thing without us having to go ahead and say how we did it. How do I want to do this tonight, sir? We're doing this six things style tonight because each of us has a list of topics that we want to talk about. Are we going traditional and rolling our 2d20 and taking the lower of the dice? How are we doing this?
I think that makes sense, and you may have caught me unaware, but I'm going to grab my Star Trek dice.
I do that a lot. It's okay.
You caught me unprepared. Yeah. You spent the momentum and jumped the gun. Good call.
Hey, come on now. Wait a minute. I'm spending threat. I'm not spending momentum.
All right. I have my command dice.
As do I.
2d20 and take the lowest.
2d20 and take the lowest.
I've got a 2.
I've got a 9. Yeah, no.
But I think because I actually rolled a 20, that complication means you get to go first, sir.
That's totally fine. Yeah. We did not have the expanded complication range, so my 19 did not count, but you're correct. With the 2 threat that I have gained from your complication, I will steal the initiative from you.
Excellent.
And see what it did there? See what it did there?
That was
there?
Beautiful.
See, those really, are the kind of things that we're talking
really
about.
Well,
yes.
Done.
Yeah, it's really well done. Yeah. So I think the one that I'm going to talk about first is, I'm not going to talk about extended challenges first, even though we just talked about that. I'm going to talk about probably the biggest change in second edition, or if nothing else, the one that has got the most attention from people that are looking at second edition, and that's the removal of challenge dice from everything. That's, they are no longer in combat, they're no longer in extended challenges. Combat is now just done where your weapon has traits and has a set of damage. So your phaser does 2 points of damage, and it has certain traits depending on how it is that you're using it. And those traits are really what are going to be most important. I know, Lee Winnicker, you're going to talk about traits in a little bit, so I'm not going to dive too much into that. But let us sit back for just a moment and applaud the brave choice to remove those beloved D6s from this game. This is absolutely the right decision. And this is what I was talking about at the show open, when I was talking about how, like, rules can get convoluted. There was a lot of rolling for a little bit of advance, because first you have to go ahead and roll the challenge. Then you have to roll the dice. Then you have to look, well, how many pips did I get? How many How many sixes did I get? You know, have to, there's a lot of kind of mental math and stuff that's going on for a very simple resolution, and it bogged it down. This is going to help combat run smoother and better going forward. And oh, holy crap, is it going to help extended challenges also, because now there's just the threshold, and now it's every time you're doing things, you know, you have your particular move that you're making to go ahead and move through the extended challenge. It either succeeds or it doesn't, and if it succeeds, depending on how many successes you get and everything like that, things can change as you're spending momentum and or buying thread or whatever like that. All those things still come into play, but basically everything still just has a resolution cost or a resolution amount, effect, and that's just what it does, period. It's all about the traits now going forward, and I think this is such a beautiful, brilliant, bold choice. I really want to applaud the writers who said, you know what, do we actually need these? No, we don't. Let's get them out. I think it's fantastic.
I cannot express how happy I am with that change. Nate Dowdell, the lead game designer as far as the 2D20 mechanic across all Modiphius systems, really pulled out the stops when they went back to the drawing board for second edition on the mechanics. How do we make this game easier to adopt, more fun to play, faster at the table, more narrative, more enjoyable? They have other 2D20 games that have already eliminated the challenge dice, and there are some games where the challenge dice makes a lot of sense. I think maybe they should take it away from those games. Necessarily. I've been playing Fallout lately, and I find that it makes more sense in Fallout to have that piece there. I've only played two sessions and sat in on one other, so I'm not nearly as well versed in Fallout. I will report back in several months as far as my end thoughts on whether or not that makes sense for that game. But it is definitely an issue that they heard the feedback, heard the fans talking about, and paid attention, and then designed their way out of those concerns. Absolutely agree. It's just going to make things easier, more fun, and definitely, this is Star Trek. A phaser is what a phaser does.
Yep.
All apologies to Forrest Gump. Unless you are spending a trait to have it do more damage, or have it do something else, or making an opportunity cost, or spending threat, or what have you, I don't think it should change. It makes sense. The difference between on stun and kill setting is in the choices you make, and I don't think it should fall down to a random dice. It removes that bad feeling when I hit with the coolest hit, all the dice, I hit all the criticals, and I did zero damage or one damage because they have some kind of resistance and all I rolled was two ones on my challenge dice. That feels bad at the table, and I get it. Nothing should be a cakewalk. Everything should be a challenge. But guess what? There's a lot of things in Star Trek that have two resistance, three resistance. And if your phaser only does two, guess what you're not doing? You're not getting through that resistance unless you make those same choices we just spoke about. So what difference does it make in the grand scheme of things? It just speeds up the game, makes it more fun, makes more narrative sense.
Absolutely. So, perfect. All right, sir, which one do you want to talk about next?
So I'm going to jump into something that's really more about the look and feel of the book, and that is really the flowcharts and all the easy reference material that's in there. I'm going to start with the layout and the typeface, just the structure of the way the flowcharts work and where they chose to place them was just brilliant layout decisions. Earlier, I gave credit to Nate Dowdell for working on the mechanics and fine-tuning them. I'm going to throw this credit right to Jim Johnson for what I can only imagine based on conversations he's held on other podcasts, on live streams that he's done about this product and about other products. Clear to me that his guiding principle as far as the look and feel of this book and its ease of adoption was make it clear, make it accessible, make it work. And it does all of those things in spades. I think it was late last night or early this morning, had commented on one of the groups about that factor and how much I love the charts and said thank you. Because, look, I'm going to be very truthful with everybody here. I've said it before, and I'll keep saying it. I'm a person who's neurodivergent, and I struggle with the way things are laid out with a lot of game products. It's not unique to Star Trek First Edition. I have that massive issue with 5th of 2014 also. I didn't care for the way in which information was ordered in that book, the DMG and all of that. I have had that problem with many games. I've said on the show several times that it used to be, even if I really wanted to play a game, I literally had to hand it to Glenn so he could distill it for me so it made sense in my head, because I struggled with, I'm a smart guy, I can read the information, but sometimes just the way in which the information is delivered messes me all up. Like, I get the wrong impression, understanding of the rules because of the order of operations that something is put in. And I find that this clicks. This makes sense to me as an individual. What I'm hearing is lots of people are loving the way this looks. And I will let you know as I play with more and more newer players, as I get out to my local shop and I get out to conventions here. Again, I'm doing some playtests and encounter run-throughs at a major convention coming up. If that holds true for everybody and people who've never played this before or may not have played role-playing games before, I have a strong sense that that's exactly what you need. In specific, attributes and the way they interact with departments or with various roles, there's a series of nicely done charts on that where it says if you're using this attribute and you're trying to do these things, it basically gives you several examples of each of those so you, anybody at a glance can get an idea how they respond to a challenge. Oh, I'm doing this. Oh, here's an example of how to do that. Focuses, the chart there, it's nicely laid out. It's well done as far as how it's spaced. There's not too much information. There's not too little information. Well done. Life path, character creation, the flowchart that starts that chapter lets you know what to look for as you go through the life path, sets you up in the order. Picture perfect. Creation and play, that's an option that was always there. It was always in the core book, and I made zero sense of it. I knew in my head it's you pick things later on when you do it, but I was not grokking what that part of the book was about. I understand it now. I now know how to do that if that comes up and becomes a thing we have to do. Pretty much anything that has a process to it, there's a flowchart for it. Anything that has a lot of options or information, there's a chart for that that you can go to an easy reference. Spoiler alert for when I talk in greater detail about the GM toolkit, many of those charts are reprinted in single card format that you can sit at a table with a bunch of players and hand those out for the player in a given role or the player trying to do a given set of tasks. That's a carryover from the original starter kit and the tricorder kit as well. They had those there as well. So that's not new. They've actually done that in the past, but I think, again, just the style, the layout, it's not Elkar's. It just does all the things.
Yeah. So first off, a lot in there to go ahead and talk about. I think the one that really caught my attention is when you were talking about how they have provided more and better information on how to navigate a challenge based on which attribute and department you want to use or should use to go ahead and do that. That is a throwback to a cheat sheet that I use when running the game, specifically when I'm running Preservations. I have a cheat sheet next to me that says, basically has a chart format that has like the, it's still first edition, so it has the disciplines on one side, attributes on the other. It has basically like a one or two sentence description of what that challenge is based on what their combination is. So it's, oh, if you are judging, if you're trying to evaluate the mental state of a person or someone that's opposite you, this is the attribute and discipline that you should be medicine, blah, 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 right? So it lays it out. That has been very useful to me as a storyteller when I am working with players and they say that, when I say, okay, you can go ahead and make a two difficulty challenge to go ahead and do that. What should I roll? Let's talk about it. Here's, can I roll this? That seems more like something else based on the description. How about this instead? That kind of negotiation that you do at the table. The fact that they have now taken that from the great continuing conversations source and brought it back into the core book, fantastic. And it's a fantastic addition. It's really going to help players that need that information, especially now that it's in the GM tools too, so that you can go ahead and make it like shareable, which is fantastic. And the other thing I think that you mentioned that, man, has gotten some interesting press is the change in the layout from that very traditional TNG LCARS format. People really, really loved that. And that was one thing that when they opened up this PDF and they saw that was not there at all, that it if I may be so bold, looks like a regular role-playing game book. There were some mixed feelings about that. I think that people understand why that is, but maybe don't necessarily grasp that it had to happen that way. I think that it makes more sense. I think that it helps the layout. You know, I think that it definitely helps find things aren't hidden within a little bit of a screen or they're not hidden in a title bar or something like that. It helps it make a little bit more sense because it has a very standardized layout format. Like, headings are red, they are bold, they are big, and then if there are requirements, that's in bold and it's in one line. It helps the flow of the book to go ahead and be a little bit less artistic and a little bit more straightforward. So
yeah. Look, there is nothing wrong with the artistic qualities and the
sure
narrative connection that I feel with LCARS. It is everything and a major... I wouldn't say everything, but it is a major...
We use them in our game all the time. Like, yeah,
it is a major part of TNG and identifying the Star Trek-ness of certain eras. It is very era-specific in many ways, so that's yep. a quality. And while the color scheme for this book is clearly set with the show that's on air, Burning Down Barns right now, Strange New Worlds, I'm fine with that. That makes sense. That's a great business decision, and it looks gorgeous. So I have no qualms about that whatsoever. But in the effort to make the game multicultural, as far as in canon, in narrative, multicultural, all the societies, not just the default Federation, in an effort to make it multi-era role play, so folks who want to play TOS or folks who want to play Old Discovery or 32nd Century Discovery or want to play Voyager or want to play DS9 or want to play Lower Decks or want to play Picard or anywhere in between, by not having it LCARS, it gives an artistic way of expressing the freedom to play outside the TNG DS9 Voyager box.
There's a universality to it.
That's really, really important. At some point, if they wanted to have handouts in some future module, oh, you get this communique from Admiral, like we do in our show from time to time. If you wanted that individual handout to be LCARS, chef kiss. But the actual book, the information that people refer to and go back to look up things, to find things, to search, even if it's digital, that doesn't need to be LCARS.
Yep. Yeah, and a shout out also to, since we're mentioning it, the person that we have on staff who does those LCARS displays for Preservations in particular, fantastic layout artist who does really, really great work making sure that those LCARS images are fantastic. He knows who he is. I'm not going to go ahead and call him out by name, but does fantastic, really great work for making sure that our Preservations artwork is top-notch. I'm sure that if you ask him, he will share it with you if you'd like. Might even share the affinity files if you ask really, really nicely. That's
yeah.
And folks, choose your next words carefully.
I was going to say, so folks, if you want to know who that individual is, hashtag call your boys TTJ. Join our Facebook group or our community group. Ask that question. I'm sure that individual will respond at some point.
Yes, individual will respond, yes.
Yeah. I will also say a friend of the show, Marty Napier, who does a lot on Foundry with Star Trek for the Expeditions game. He has done some amazing work with LCARS and setting that up and having things work very beautifully there as well, including having connections and links. Like if you click on a certain part of the ship, he'll actually have an interior map of that room show up on screen. We largely do the game Theater of Mind, so it's not like we're moving tokens on a board, but visually it's engaging, it's engrossing, and it's there. LCARS, it's not going away. If you're running this game, make it a part of your game. Make it be there if that's the area you're playing in. But what you don't have to worry about now is that slowing down other elements of your game.
Yep, exactly. All right, if you can believe it, we are already halfway through the show, so we're going to step aside for a minute to go ahead and pay some bills here in the middle of the show, and then we will be right back. Welcome to the middle of the show. We wanted to take a minute and thank the people who helped make this show possible, our Patreon supporters. We like to shout out our adventurer level Patreons, so extra big thanks to Tim Morris, Joe Harney, Dave Rideout, Adam Scaramella, and Marty Napier. Patreon supporters get exclusive content, free copies of all of our published and unpublished game supplements, early access to episodes, and free invitations to our monthly games. You can learn more at www.patreon.com/ttjourneys.
Speaking of published material, have you checked out the supplements we have on DM's Guild? We have two full books, The Traveler's Guide to Collaborative Worldbuilding, The Traveler's Guide to the Multiverse, and you can combine it with all of our supplements to make your next role legendary. Go to www.ttjourneys.com/DM's Guild for more information.
If you're looking for Tabletop Journeys swag or need a fantastic set of new dice, then you should check out the Tabletop Journeys Spring Store and our affiliate, FanRoll Dice. You can make your first purchase through FanRoll at 10% off, and every purchase helps support the show. You can learn more about that at www.ttjourneys.com/FanRoll. And if you want to get some awesome t-shirts, hoodies, hats, or other gear, check out www.ttjourneys.com/swag to get redirected to our Spring Store. These are the same vendors that we use for our add-ons when we do Kickstarters and stand by their products.
But the best way you can support the show is by joining the conversation. Did you love one of the episodes? Did you disagree with something we said? Maybe you just want us to cover your favorite game system a little more or talk about a brand new system. Check us out at linktr.ee/TTJourneys. That's our link tree. And join the conversation.
We hope you're enjoying this week's show, so here comes the second half. Don't forget to subscribe to the show wherever you're listening to us, and if your platform lets you leave a comment or a rating, why not hit the button and show your support? Thanks again for listening, and now on with the show. Back after our mid-show here, we're continuing with our episode 6 Things About Star Trek Adventures 2nd Edition. We've already gone through our first couple at the beginning of the show. I was talking about the removal of challenge dice. Liwinika, you were talking about
flowcharts and the layout of
the
book
and the way that it's looking. Yeah. Yep. So I'm going to go ahead and dive into my next one here, and that's going to be the way that they have changed extended challenges.
Yeah.
They weren't confusing because they basically worked like combat, but they were definitely cumbersome. There was a heavy lift involved, which a lot of people in the community had gone to great lengths to make tools to go ahead and help the lift on extended challenges be easier.
Thank you very much to Bill Barato. Your extended challenge spreadsheet that you had put on continuing missions and shared with me in its early iteration has made it possible for me to run that very smoothly for the last 5 to 6 months. Yeah. Can't thank you enough. What a big help that was. But I'm so glad that we don't need that kind of help anymore.
No, we don't need it anymore.
Because we've got a much smoother process.
Yeah, and let me expand on that a little bit here. So first of all, obviously the removal of challenge dice from the game impacts extended challenges and extended tasks, which is, by itself is going to help things become more streamlined. Because again, much like when you're in combat, if you fire your phaser and you hit and everything like that, and it's great, and then you roll your challenge dice, and ooh, you didn't actually do any damage, bummer. Kind of the same thing when you're working with your extended challenges. When you roll your successes, everything's fantastic, you roll your challenge dice, and you don't do any actual work. That becomes tricky to navigate narratively. The removal of challenge dice are already going to help speed along and smooth out extended tasks and extended challenges, which is great. The other thing that has changed is something that we were already doing at our tables that has now become part of the actual core rules. I'm not going to say that what we did was unique or groundbreaking or that we somehow came up with it. I'm not making that assertion whatsoever, but it is nice to go ahead and see that now we have specific rule support to go ahead and lean back on for how we were running extended challenges. challenges. We blurred the lines a little bit between extended challenges and gated challenges, right? Where we would say that an extended challenge that has a requirement of 3 or 4 breakthroughs, we would take those breakthroughs and make them narrative milestones that are certain things that need to be done in a particular order to allow us to daisy chain them together. Because what that allowed us to do is once we set up those milestones, it allowed us to go ahead and string together as work was being done. It gave us some way to make that work be meaningful and actually have context on what's going on. So here's an example that I want to go ahead and toss out on the way that we used to do it and how it's now going to be supported more specifically in second edition. If you think about the Preservations episode from season one where the crew was caught on that Breen asteroid, one of the things that Tanari was doing is that he had determined the mining colony inside the asteroid was originally a Cardassian outpost. They had found the terminal that controlled basically the hangar doors that they would need to open to get the runabout out. Tanari set to reprogram the console so that they could gain some security function over the outpost and then get the hangar bay door open eventually. And so basically on the fly, it was either a 3 or 4 breakthrough challenge that we came up with. We decided on the rules and we decided what those breakthroughs were going to be so that at any point, Tanari could have said, you know what, based on everything else that's happening right now, I don't have the time to finish this, but I have done some work, and given kind of those narrative milestones in it allowed us to go ahead and say, okay, cool. So you've only gotten halfway through the work. All is not lost. You have gained the ability to do X and to do Y. You just can't do Z and Alpha yet. That comes next, but you need to continue the work to go ahead and get back there. That kind of that narrative framework, that narrative infrastructure that we could put around the extended challenges and be able to break them up so it's not an all or nothing system, it's really nice to go ahead and see that's now baked into the cake. So they've streamlined the rules of the extended challenges. They've given them this narrative weight, and they've removed the challenge dice, which is just going to go ahead and help extended challenges move more smoothly. In season one, we had basically an entire episode that was just an extended challenge, and that episode was riveting, it was exciting, it was fast-paced, it was smooth. The extended challenge was not this albatross that we had to go ahead and get out of the way. Largely, that's because Liwanika and I hand-waved a lot of the rules. We didn't get into some of the complexity. We instead focused on the narrative aspects of extended challenges, and that has been a big change in a lot of pieces of the book, but I think it's especially showcased in the extended challenge rules.
Yeah. When we did those, and I'll talk briefly about the challenge I did in the 2-part episode that was the end of season one, beginning of season two, that's exactly why I did that. We had written into our campaign the need to get all these things, and there was no way within the mechanics to have those things done unless we just GM fiated it. That's not a good show. Or we do extended challenges because a simple challenge or even a gated challenge in that case would not feel narratively useful. What we had to do is do that challenge. But the typical extended challenge just doesn't make for good radio. So the only way I thought to make that happen is, look, if they're going to get a breakthrough, if you're going to call something a breakthrough, then that means something happened. Somebody said, Eureka. Or somebody said, oh, I've got it. Let's do this, this, and this. Or even if it failed and you're like, okay, now I know why it failed. When I get back to this, I'm going to go do it another way.
Yeah.
For me, it was I have to narratively express the breakthrough. And that's what I did. And now that we've removed challenge dice and we've streamlined the process, and they're saying when you hit these moments, these thresholds or what have you, that's when something happens. And they're asking GMs to tell the players or express through role play if the players are designing the challenge themselves or whatever, express that something. That we have always done, so that part has definitely been codified. I would not have necessarily been able to get to the way it is here and as smooth as it is here just by adding a narrative piece. So this kind of takes what we were doing and takes it the rest of the way to coolness. We were half cool. We were okay. Like, we had some shades. Yeah. We were doing all right, but we didn't get the leather jackets until Nate Dowdell and his team did the rest of the heavy lifting on this, and it's really, really good.
Yeah, I agree. Not only does expressing kind of extended challenges in this way give the breakthroughs and the milestones more more sense. It makes them make more narrative sense. It also makes the complications that arise make more sense. It's like you were talking about, oh, I failed at this last time, but I know why it was that I failed. So now maybe my difficulty range is a little bit higher, but or maybe my complication range is expanded because I've already failed, but my difficulty range probably isn't going up, or maybe even easier because I know what it was that happened and why it was that I failed. Yep. Those are the kind of things that are now supported, kind of laying into your layout point a little bit. Maybe this is the way that extended challenges were always supposed to work, and that wasn't clear. And so if they have clarified this and made it better, made it more clear that this was always the point, fantastic. If they have instead remade them to go ahead and work this way, that's fantastic too. Yeah. I'm just glad that it's there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Could not agree more. That actually brings us right to my next point, which is so much clarification. I was probably about 3/4 of the way through the book, and it dawned on me that I was reading rules not for the first time, but I was understanding them for the first time. And while some of this is certainly about layout, and some of this is certainly about flowcharts, the reality is a lot of this is just about the clarifying language and the order of operations in some case that we see things. I already spoke about some of the challenges I've had with understanding material if it's presented in weird ways. Look, I had the GM's guide and the player's guide, which explained the base rules in a much better fashion. But I never really read through those as a book cover to cover. It was always, if I was having a problem and not understanding a rule, I would first see if it was in the GM's guide or the player's guide before I'd go to the core rule book, because I'd have a better chance of understanding it, right? So I didn't have, one, a single source for the best way to understand something. Two, it was still sometimes a challenge to figure out where to locate information. In this core book, we now have all the bells and whistles. Everything is moving in the right order. The gears are meshing. We are getting work out of the torque, if I can throw in just one more metaphor there. And it is smooth. And I'm going to pick out one specific rule that I think was always there. I don't know for a fact if it was always there, because I truly don't recall ever seeing it, but it makes so much sense, and it's not something that was called out, that I want to talk about it. And one of those is personnel support mechanics. The cost for bringing in support personnel from your ship into a given scene, if there's a time crunch or other complicating factors, not necessarily a complication, not necessarily when threat is being spent, but just to do that in a given scene, there's opportunity costs. In some cases, with security teams, there's actually a threat cost in addition to the opportunity cost. I have a strong sense that that has actually always been a part of the rules, and it just never clicked.
Yeah.
However it was buried, maybe it was my eyes were too strained when I got to that part of the Elkars. Maybe it was because it was in a weird spot that I just didn't get to. I don't know, but fans of STA, if you know for a fact that was definitely part of the original rules and what we now have for personnel support is exactly what was in the original books, holler at your boy. Definitely get in the comments. Let us know. I strongly believe it was. And if not that, there are other things that certainly were. Carrying capacity for gear and equipment, much more clearly explained. So many rules. I'm not even going to list them all, because I honestly think if you play this game, get second edition, and it'll make more sense. Hell, even if your goal is to stick with first edition, get this book so you can know how these rules are supposed to work all along. I'm telling you, it's that much of a seed change for the level of understanding.
I feel like it is an important time to point out to our cast of Star Trek Preservations this opportunity cost for bringing in department members to perform specific tasks. We have not been charging that opportunity cost. That was not a GM fiat hand wave for the sake of the narrative decision. That was an oversight for Lee Wanika and I.
Yeah, we didn't know it existed.
We didn't know it existed. Unfortunately for y'all, now we know it exists. I would suspect that probably starting with episode 8, which we're going to record in a little while here.
Guaranteed.
Yeah, we're going to be bringing in the opportunity cost party members. As department heads, look at your crew allocations and think about how that has been used previously and what that's going to be like going forward. So just consider this your notice.
Let's break this out in the game and how that has impacts in the choices you make. For very narrative reasons, it's my favorite ship in Star Trek. The Saber class was what we chose for preservations. But what's interesting is if you think about the fact that your department score equals how many people are physically in a given department, and that impacts what your support personnel can be in a given scene. Now that we know there's opportunity costs for the amount of people you bring in, wow. Now things make more sense the way things narratively work. It becomes important to know how many people you can marshal to a situation and the cost thereof. For GMs that are worried about my players never give me threat, or they don't utilize momentum because they're afraid to, or because they think they're going to do the rolls even better or whatever, this is one of those factors that would help move that needle. We have really done a great job of mastering the flow of momentum and threat. Like, our players, certainly in the preservation game, have no qualms about giving threat or using momentum to fuel their abilities and fuel the way they interact with various challenges and various elements of the game. But there are times when I'm playing, and certainly when I'm at conventions or at the local shop, where I will be sitting on a relatively moderate amount of threat and momentum will stagnate. They won't use it. They're saving it for something else, or they're afraid to give threat to get the ball rolling. And I will do some things to try to get that movement. Like, I'll spend threat callously or carelessly just so they see threat goes down, so they feel comfortable throwing out a little bit more threat to get the ball rolling, right? I will mirror the things I want the players to do. This is one of those things that now it's like, hey, we need more security people here. There's a cost for that. Now it is less about saving it for a thing. It's more about, this is how we get the job done.
Yeah.
Right? And yep. So these things were always in the game. And when people wonder, how does that work? Why doesn't it flow that well for me? Any given table was probably using one or two of these variant levels and dials to get to spur on the flow of momentum and threat. My guess is not every table was using all of them, and that's why we hear about that in the community. Again, second edition, it spells things out much more clearly, so you have an idea of where to go.
Even just the way that they spelled out the difference between a reveal and a reversal. I'm not sure that they actually used the reveal term last time. Obviously, the reversal, it's 2 threat per person. It's massive change to the scene. But the reveal is merely just, I get to go ahead and reveal a fact that the players wish wasn't true. That's all that it is. But it is that I get to go ahead, it sets up a new situation, changes the nature of the scene, you know. Lee Winika, you and I were talking earlier today when you were editing one of the most recent episodes of Preservations, and you're like, hey, you said on radio that you spent threat, but we never know what it was. It's not said on radio, but you made very sure to go ahead and say out loud, hey, by the way, I'm spending 5 threat right now.
Yep.
And you weren't sure what that was. It's like, well, yeah, that's because it was XYZ. And as soon as I said that, I'm sure you probably went, oh, yeah, no, duh, of course.
Yep.
Of course.
Because we had talked about how and when to react to certain circumstances or situations.
Yep.
If X, here's an option for Y. If X, here's an additional option for Z. That was one of those options. The challenge was I, as an editor, and when I'm editing from the listener point of view, didn't know what it was, and I was curious because I have to run the next session, and I wanted to make sure I knew what it was, so I was prepared to run the next session.
So even though I did not explicitly say what the reveal was in the moment that I spent that threat, I mean, our players may tell us if I'm wrong. I'm pretty sure that they know what that threat expenditure was for. If nothing else, they figured it out in the next episode.
Of the players who are there, I can guarantee you at least one of them figured it out.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Maybe not all. Yeah. At least one of them.
My last one here, and this may be a somewhat brief, we've kind of talked about the concept a little bit here in a variety of different capacities. The symptom that I'm going to talk about, or that makes it sound negative, but the thing I'm going to talk about is the fact that they have brought the reputation system from the Klingon book into the core rules and replaced the previous reputation system for advancement. Kudos, fabulous choice, excellent choice. that reputation system just works so much better. It is so much more thematic. It is smoother and makes more sense. Fantastic. It's a fantastic addition. That's the superficial compliment that goes along here, right? The deeper compliment that actually comes from this is, way to go, writing team.
Mike Oda Zibing, Eskewe, Tilly Bridges, and Susan Bridges, Rachel Cruz, Allison Saib, Michael Desmuke, Nate Dowdell, Keith Garrett, Pat Goodman, Jim Johnson, Fred Love, Dr. Aaron McDonald, Aaron Pelea, J.D. Kennedy, Chris McCarver, Troy Mapins, and Al Spader.
Kudos to you all for taking the 8 years since the first edition book came out and learning how to write mechanics for this game that make the game better, and be willing to go ahead and say, hey, this thing is better than the way we did it before. How do we actually weave that back into the game in a proper sense? So kudos to you for being, I don't know, together, you know, with it enough to go ahead and say, you know what, that reputation system needs some work. We wrote a pretty good one in the Klingon book. How do we bring that in instead? How do we make that one kind of the core mechanic, as opposed to having these two conflicting mechanics, and one doesn't really work that great? We did it better over here. Let's do that instead.
Yeah. I would also say thank you for this. Thank you for loving this game and caring about this IP and caring about Wii fans. And I know nearly, if not every single person on that team also plays this game. The fact that you knew what you wanted at your own tables and knew how to make that accessible to everyone, thank you. Thank you for the love you've shown to my favorite IP. I cannot thank you enough. The reputation system is something we've struggled with in our own games, in our Patreon games, in our preservation games, candidly, off mic. How do we advance? We kind of hand-waved in Season 1. At the end of Season 1, I gave out a trait for, or towards the end of Season 1, I gave out a trait for the folks who were on that mission. The end of Season 1, I gave out some additional traits. There were some promotions that were done. None of it was mechanical. None of it had anything to do with the rules. It was, I felt after a full season, there needed to be improvement, and I had no idea. I didn't understand or grok the rules well enough to do it by that. It seemed like a lot of heavy lifting that I didn't care for, and I didn't want to subject my players to. So I hand-waved and just did the thing. And my plan was, you know what? That works better for our table. We'll just do that. With the new system, as it's been written into second edition, now I think we can get back to the actual rules as written for this, and it won't feel harsh. It won't feel like an imposition. There's a beautiful handout that comes with the PDF versions that is pretty simple, a sentence or two. It might even just be the title of the mission or what have you, and players will simply mark the values that they utilize, whether those things were used positively or negatively. Then there's a very simple, and a flowchart for it, by the way, mechanic for determining whether that ended up going well or poorly, so your reputation. And then there's a quick mechanic for determining your reputation score at the end of a given mission, and now you'll tally what kind of things you get to do. You get enough of those, and then all of a sudden you can start getting advancements. I will also throw in here, they clarified, again, always the rule, how advancement for supporting characters work. Much more clear. And I know the preservation's cast is enamored with the supporting folks that they work with, whether it be mm-hmm. Ensign Lusan, Dr. New, Lieutenant Kem,
LJG Dory,
Dory, or what have you. And the fact that there's now a great mechanic for that, I can tell you, for our cast members, we'll be looking back at our previous adventures, seeing when these folks came up. We will get them up to speed with where they should be as we shift into second edition. It's not like they're starting from scratch and then they start doing these advances. We'll get them advanced. That will probably take place going into season 2. We are going to be making some of these shifts immediately, some of these shifts shortly. The last of these shifts will definitely be in place by the time we start season 3.
Season 2. All right, Mr. Miller, last one on your list. What do you got? You get the big one, right?
Yeah, I got the big one because it handles everything. It is one of the things we talked about, big mechanics changes. We talked about layout changes and how that impacts us. Challenge dice for the mechanics, the layout and the color schemes and all those other things. But what we didn't mention is one of the ways, again, to move the needle with the threat and momentum and how to make things more or less challenging, and that's traits. Everything has traits or has the opportunity to have traits. And more importantly, the emphasis and the utilization of traits becomes so much more important. The life path and the character creation process now really clarifies and details how, when you should be adding traits and when you can add more traits, gives GM pretty much carte blanche to add appropriate traits for what has happened. They just use them more. Species traits are improved and do more lifting because he really always should have. Ship traits, there are more of them that are detailed and described so you have a better understanding. I saw just when they were talking about names of ships and they're going into some of the conventions, first of its name, legacy and things like that. There's all kinds of these ship traits that are really important and need to really be clarified and needed to be clarified and codified, and they are now. Weapons, the various traits that Josh mentioned when he was talking about piercing and all these other things.
So we were talking about ship combat and how piercing as an ability actually allows photon torpedoes to be somewhat scary now in ship combat. They can gain a specific trait. Piercing salvo. Yeah, when you make a torpedo attack, you may spend 2 momentum and add the piercing quality. And the piercing quality basically ignores resistance in any other ship. So the way that you can stack traits,
it is so narratively cool the way you can do different things, and it really calls to mind various Star Trek movies, original era motion picture era movies, where you have Bones and Spock working on a torpedo. They're getting ready to do things. You've got Sulu putting yourself in the right position. You've got Kirk distracting them over comms. Then the torpedo is going to be doing its thing, putting the sensor on the photon torpedo or whatever. I'm a doctor. It can't be that much different than surgery. So you have in that one scene, you have an extended task. You have them basically an extended task to add a trait to a torpedo while somebody else is creating a trait to distract them and make it easier to make the hit. And then bam, now it's all happening like that. That is
perfection. You've got ship combat featuring people not doing ship combat tasks. That's like all those sorts of things. Like that, these are all the possibilities now that second edition seems to have brought back to the forefront. Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. And then the traits that come along with reputation. And while it has always been there to some extent, the fact that it's codified and explained clearly in the right sections where players will see it means that as a GM, when I trot out, you're on the Dalamis Christian. You're on the hero of such and such battle. You're the savior of the Zindi insectoids. So well done. Better explanation on how reputation and awards work. It's codified it. So you now can, characters will do things in the game, which might make them eligible for awards, and then they can spend their meta currency, so to speak, to get the various rewards. Now those things also become traits that they have. As we're going through the next season, it makes me want to write a scene where they're all going to have to be in their dress uniforms so I can, on air, have them describe their medals. Like, I am looking forward to being able to do that because we now have the meat and potatoes to serve that particular dish. With all apologies to the Klingons, this one is going to be hot.
That's horrible. It was
wonderful.
Just deplorable, really.
It was deplorable, but you loved that in so many ways.
Yeah. You gave me 2 threads at the beginning of the show, so I'm going to go ahead and spend it right now to add the trait muted microphone to Liwanika. I appreciate the chef's kiss. That's fabulous. Yeah, exactly. So that's our breakdown of second edition. And honestly, so many things that we have not even scratched the surface of. Like, we picked out like our favorite things that we found in here, or at least the things that we think are going to make the most impact into our Star Trek games and the things that we're going to use. But there's a lot in this book. They really worked really, really hard to make this book really, really great. So if you are at all into Star Trek Adventures, I definitely recommend pick up second edition, read through it, know it, love it. And like we mentioned at the top of the show, if you're not a member of some of the Star Trek Adventures groups out on Facebook in particular, join them. There's a lot of really great conversations happening there about this book. It's a good time.
Yeah, and in addition to that, join us. Chime in. If you're listening to this episode, it's not going to be too hard to find Star Trek Reservations. That's the actual play that we do here on Tabletop Journeys. You're going to have a blast listening to that show. I made the comment in a chat I had with one of the players. Our cast is impressive. Impressive with the way they address situations. They make Josh and I work hard to challenge them. I am blown away consistently, and that's the way a great table works. In addition to the Star Trek Preservation show, which is in the back half of its second season, we also have play Star Trek Adventures as one of our monthly Patreon games. And we'd love to have more folks join us. If you have questions, certainly our Facebook group, certainly in the comments here. By all means, you can always go to www.patreon.com/TTJourneys. You can join in and see what we're all talking about. You can get a seat at the table. To play this game, there are a lot of ways to do it, but just join. Even if you want to just check it out and see what's going on, occasionally we have table openings that we offer at all levels. Be happy to have you join us. So by all means, go ahead, see what works for you, test it out, check it out. You'll have a blast. We've got older episodes for how first edition works, and we'll have more episodes with how second edition works, and that'll almost entirely be via the actual play. So you'll see us talk about the rules, you'll see us make conversions to the new rules, and then you'll see those new rules get played out real time as the show goes. We look forward to hearing from you, seeing you, and if you're in New England and you're in the general area, or if you're at a Catacon in November of this year, you can always grab a seat at my table, because I also run the game live at any time I get a chance.
Absolutely. All right, everybody, that is our episode for the evening. Hope you enjoyed. Love to go ahead and hear your feedback. As Lee Winiga said, join the conversation. Let us know how we can help, and let us know what questions you've got and what do you think of the episode. Our episode on Quest from the Infinite Staircase comes out next Friday, and episode six of Preservations actually wraps up this coming Tuesday, episode 7 beginning shortly thereafter. That is our show for the evening. Until then, yeah, have a great week. We'll talk to you then. Thanks so much for listening, everybody.
Good night, all.